As the world gets back up and running, a major rethink of how we use and share space is underway. And in many cases, the past few months have merely accelerated what was already happening and how businesses of all sizes are working. Today, the same things are as important as ever for businesses in finding talent, connecting with potential partners and investors, prototyping and road testing ideas, having space for the team to meet and engage, and of course, for entertaining clients. And as we'll hear, that can all happen under one roof, alongside ventures at various stages of their journey and of all sizes. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bache. This week, we meet Matt Hunter, the co-founder and co-CEO of PlusX, the first purpose-built facility for tech, innovation, and hardware pioneers here in the UK. Their first location is now open in Brighton on England's south coast, with plans to open hubs in cities like Birmingham, Manchester, Oxford, and perhaps even London. As you'll hear, the idea is to create space for finding talent and growing businesses outside of major centers, so that people don't always have to commute into the capital to work and can choose the lifestyle they like while also being able to connect with great people and businesses in person. Matt is the former chief design officer at the Design Council and a Silicon Valley digital product design veteran. Alongside his co-founder Paul Rostes, PlusX is the culmination of 5 years of work and an incredible vision for how we use physical space. Here's my conversation now with Matt.
So PlusX is a growing network of innovation hubs across the UK. And our purpose is pretty clear. It's to help ambitious businesses to grow and to innovate. And our view, I suppose, is both that people need help in order to innovate and to grow, both big companies, medium size and small ones, but also we should be doing this in the place where there's the talent. And the talent exists outside of central London as much as it exists within London. So we're really excited that our first full-scale PlusX innovation hub is in the city of Brighton, because Brighton is one of those cities which is sort of, on the one hand, known as a seaside destination, a tourist town, but on the other hand, actually is full of amazing creative talent and of digital talent. And what we find sometimes is both that those talented people sometimes end up commuting to London because it's within an hour of London, so you get that kind of brain drain. But equally, because Brighton's got two really good universities, you can find that those graduates actually become almost overqualified for local roles. So you've got all of this talent, both because people want to live in Brighton and they want to study in Brighton, and somehow there aren't those jobs. So we reckon both that for people who want better jobs and better pay and local economies that want to thrive, helping ambitious businesses is the way to go. So we're building this network one hub at a time, Brighton first, but maybe next Manchester, Birmingham, Southampton, loads of cities we're talking to at the moment.
That's very exciting. I'm curious to hear a little bit more about why you would choose to be outside of a city like London. Obviously, there is all the positives you've just mentioned on talent and boosting the local economy, but talk to me a little bit about the model you decided on and why you chose a city like Brighton.
Yeah, for me, talent is a really interesting topic. And there are many, you know, innovative theories. I'm sure many of your listeners know of Entrepreneur First as a really interesting sort of accelerator program that thinks actually supporting those founders is even more important than the idea. Venture capitalists, angel investors and VCs, I've found, have a particular view on talent, which is, well, from their investment point of view, they want to make the best possible investments. And let's face it, VC is a really tough game. So what they say, I think in some ways, is we only want the most capable, the most passionate, the most driven people to make it to our door. So we're going to kind of sit back, cross our arms and expect them to come to us. We want them to live in the mega cities and to come and knock on our doors. And that's fine. But we've got a slightly different view. And our view, we're not in there to invest purely in these businesses. We're in the business of sort of building capacity. We actually work in partnership with government just as much as with other sort of private sector and non-profit sectors. And when you think about it in a public benefit sense, you know, UK PLC, a whole country, actually what you're saying is there's talent everywhere. It just doesn't have the right opportunity. And more than that, the number of people that really want to commute all the time and move around is lower than you might think. And so actually what we need to do, the right approach, is mostly to go where the talent is. I mean, we can't go everywhere, but we can go beyond the mega cities. So I guess our thesis is let's go to the 20 or 30 or so leading entrepreneurial, exciting, innovative, university-driven cities of the UK to start with, and abroad maybe. But let's start with that. And we can assure you there is a lot of talent there, and there is a lot of talent that is not getting the right breaks and probably don't have the confidence to see themselves as entrepreneurs. Because I think there's another context here, which is far too few people in most even developed nations see themselves as business founders and owners. What most people say is that Silicon Valley, the place where I was lucky to start my career, is one of those places where now it is abnormal not to be there as part of a startup or founding a startup. Almost everywhere else, it is abnormal to be doing this. And we just wanted to be more normal to be an entrepreneur.
That's absolutely fascinating. And in this time in particular, when a lot of people and business founders and others with great ideas will be looking for a little bit of a boost, from everything from government grants to just a little bit of support. So talk to me a little bit about the people that might be in this space, because this is a quite a broad spectrum of people you're looking to attract.
Yes, I think our view absolutely is that we need to support businesses, but we also actually need a range of businesses almost to work with one another. So yes, we support early stage startups. Again, it could be in this context, people who've graduated recently, but it could actually be people who are more mid-career and have just been made redundant and have always had that idea. How can we support them in those very, very early stages to refine their ideas and to give them the practical support to succeed? But then the next stage on, I suppose, is what we might term a scale up. Maybe we're moving from 20 people and we want to get to 60 or 100 or 200. And actually places like Brighton have a few of those, but they also lack some of the infrastructure. I mean, most simply put, they lack the office spaces with the right facilities. But also, as we all know, in this world of uncertainty, the world of startups is uncertain. And so the idea of taking a 5-year or a 10-year lease is also crazy, which is why we've seen this general flexible office market grow. But then also there's the bigger businesses. And again, this is the sort of maybe a bigger, more mature business that needs to innovate, may have been hit by COVID-19 effects. And so they want to be more digital typically, and they want to be more innovative as a culture. Now, again, Brighton historically has lacked the ability to attract those types of businesses. What we recognize is that not only can we offer flexible space and innovation support and specialist facilities, but it's by combining these small, medium-sized and big businesses together that you get knowledge exchange. So what most people agree now is that actually sharing knowledge, sharing the journey of innovation is the right way to go. We can be too competitive with one another. And actually what we need is the big businesses to learn from the small businesses and the small businesses to learn from the big businesses and to trade as well. Because big businesses, while they sometimes can lack the spark of new ideas and the innovation, the early stage ideas, their systems almost crush those early stage ideas. The thing about bigger businesses, obviously, is that they have those infrastructures for delivery, for launching, for scaling. Whereas the small businesses, of course, are all about the new idea, but they understand much less about what it is to deliver things at scale and to grow, from HR systems to IT systems to logistics to security. And so I think we see a lot of knowledge exchange between the two. And then there's a final part, I suppose, which is to what extent will any business be fundamentally having to rethink innovation at this point? You know, we've seen a huge amount of change in customer preference, of regulation, and these are just two of the many drivers of innovation. And so we need to help people move as quickly and confidently as possible to adapt their business, often to make it more digital, more service oriented, perhaps. These are many of the ways in which, you know, businesses are being made more resilient.
Well, it's interesting in how you describe innovation. I think the other interesting thing that caught my eye about the space is your ability to support companies that are designing physical things as well. If I understand correctly, you spent a lot of your career in Silicon Valley, as you mentioned, working on digital product and service, which, let's say, in the last recession and 10 years ago in the financial crash, a lot of people might have been looking down that avenue. Right now, I think a lot of people might be looking more at actually designing things and designing things better for our world. So talk to me a little bit about how that plays into what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, personally, I was very lucky. I trained first as an industrial designer, you know, so the back end of 20th century manufacture, and then retrained as a digital designer. And it was this fusion of hardware and software, of product and service, that made me, I suppose, have a valuable skill set in Silicon Valley. But now I think, yes, absolutely, after many decades of software eating the world, as has been said, I think we all recognize that actually so many true innovation challenges lie in the physical world. We only have to think about the two big ones, human health and planetary health. These exist in the physical world. They are atoms, as much as bits. And so therefore, the ability to manipulate our physical environment successfully so that we can be well and so that we don't damage the planet, these do require physical skills. I was really struck when we were first doing our research for PlusX in Brighton, speaking to various innovation companies. Some of them were pure software plays, some of them were design driven, some of them were engineering driven. And I spoke to a design company that had been speaking to a local flexible working providers or co-working space, and they were trying to be lured in with all manners of discounts. And the designer said to me, the problem is that we want to bring a soldering iron just to do a little bit of electronics work. We've been told we can't take that in for health and safety reasons. Now, this is just because, when we're soldering, actually it does emit noxious gases, and so you do need filtration. But my point generally is that health and safety, that we're all much more familiar with now than we used to be in standard offices, is just about ergonomics at your desk. We, on the other hand, understand what it is to have circular saws and 3D printers and milling machines and everything else running 24/7. And so what we found is that not only does innovation have to have a physical component as well as a virtual component, but most infrastructures are not willing to put it in place. It's just too difficult. So the health and safety implications of one of our founders in Brighton is actually boiling up fish bones, fish waste and algae to create bioplastics. We had other people in our West London facility taking potato waste and turning it into bioplastics in the partnerships with McCain. We've got people clearly, using circular saws, as I said. And so again, all of these things, perhaps again, this is, this would have not raised any eyebrows 50 years ago when people were doing these physical things. But these days, in the world of laptops being, all you need in order to make a $1 billion company, apparently, we've all sort of fallen out of the skill set of what it is to be managing all of these things. And it usually does come down to partly a skill set and knowledge about how to cook up these chemicals and do the biochemical work or how to manufacture things. It is not true to say that 3D printers have resolved all manufacturing issues and you just print it out and it's done. Manufacturing is still a very, very technical and difficult discipline. But more than that, it's the health and safety implications that mean that actually, the vast majority of places that entrepreneurs could go do not offer that support. So I think more than anything, what we found when we were trying to work out how to sort of reinvent the co-working market and to provide, defensible differentiation in the marketplace was to really focus on a few things that really mattered. And so more than anything, we make great architecture. We have fantastic world-class architects and we have ultra fast internet, because that's the one thing that if it breaks, everyone leaves. So our Brighton building is on track to be graded as WideScore Platinum. This has got the same internet resilience as the Shard in London and the Empire State Building. But at the same time, we've got this curated collaboration. How can we support 100 person teams as well as one person teams? Not every co-working space manages to span across the scale. We've got these specialist facilities, and this will be everything from electronics labs to bio wet labs to, 3D printers and milling machines, but also podcasting and video casting. So how do we all make this high quality media without just sitting under a duvet in our bedrooms? But then beyond that is all of this stuff around programs. So we've just launched actually in Brighton a £10 million business support program. So this is all about, on the one hand, connecting with universities for researchers. So contract researchers, it's known. How do you get the deep experts in universities to help you develop a new business model, a new route to market, a new technology, perhaps? An awful lot of startup support has recognized the power of peer-to-peer support. So a lot of what we're going to be doing is clustering together entrepreneurs with businesses that hopefully don't see themselves as overly competitive, It's a very subtle curation challenge. How is my business similar enough to yours that I feel your ideas might be relevant to mine, but not so close to my business that I feel threatened by you? So that's a subtle one. And then ultimately, an awful lot around health and well-being as well. It's been really fascinating to see a journey where if you go back 10 years at least to the design of physical space, its sort of visual attraction was everything. You know, Google was famous for making offices that were visually exciting, probably with a slide and a red phone box if it was in London or something. And it was almost like sort of visual marketing. Work here, it's cool because it looks cool. And I think people recognize that, but they also understand it can be a bit superficial. These days, what's really making a difference is a focus on health and well-being. So we operate our businesses, our buildings, to a new standard called WELL 2.0. It's a Californian standard, as you would expect. And it looks at so many aspects of air quality, access to physical space and to exercise, food and nutrition, just general health advice about taking a break and everything. And all of our frontline staff are mental first aid trained. What that means is that they recognize stress responses. They recognize when people are going beyond mere sort of anxiety to much more serious conditions, which might need more formal medical help. So for me, it's just really interesting also understanding where the frontiers are of value, both in a sort of I'm an entrepreneur and I want to work 24 hours a day, but also actually in that wider sense of this is 2020. So entrepreneurship doesn't just mean you're 17 years old, male, and working all the hours of the day. You know, you need to be in many stages of life from many backgrounds, have many different work styles, and we need to support you in the way that best suits you.
Of course, the original concept from you and your co-founder is that this will move into other communities, other cities across the UK. Talk to me about how that growth might look. Obviously, the last few months may have changed your forward planning slightly, but how does that get off the ground in other places, and where are you at the moment?
Yes, so we're actually talking to many cities at the moment. And I think what's really positive is that perhaps almost because of COVID, people recognize the need to make local economies thrive. In other words, in the UK, the whole idea that we needed to support cities outside of central London to level up, as the government put it, was already understood. Now, of course, we know that COVID-19 has disproportionately affected some communities, especially those often with particular groups of people that have struggled to get to work, or those that are like coastal communities that are very tourism focused. And so actually the need for government support for business is even greater. So when we speak to a city, we speak to the city leadership, we speak to the local universities, we speak to local business groups, and of course we speak to the entrepreneurs and the business owners themselves. And usually what we find is that, you know, we will be, as with all business, trying to look at supply and demand. You know, how much demand is there for offers of our type, and how much supply is there in the market where we wouldn't really be differentiated? But what we're generally finding is there can be a lot of bits of support for startups. As I say, tons of co-working and flexible office provision, and sort of maybe lots of accelerator programs and things, but they're not often very connected together. And so usually we find just by beginning to speak to the universities and the local authorities, local government especially, but also what are called LEPs, the local economic partnerships. These are these sort of the organizations through which central government pushes business growth money. It's by speaking to a few of these that you begin to see whether the planets are aligning, really. It is like that. You've got all these different bits and pieces, and people are either, it's either the right moment or it isn't for something to move forward. But we've been approached by different bits in different places. So actually working with our strategic partners, U&I Group in Manchester, they were already working with the local authorities, and there's a really interesting conversation there. But in Southampton, we were approached separately by a private sector organization that wanted to do more with a building they had, wanted to turn it into a marine tech innovation cluster. But equally, the local authority, the local government, the city council were really interested. And both universities, Southampton University and Solent University, equally excited by this prospect of a general innovation ecosystem, but also one especially that might focus on marine tech. So we just keep on having these conversations. And it's remarkable in many ways how complicated it is. And so to some extent, you can't draw a clear line of sight about how the world is going to move forward. You just have to be juggling lots of opportunities, and then the timing will be right for one or more. What we're also finding is that if you think about it, the high street, you know, retail environments have been under pressure for many years, decades, many would argue, and then more recently because of the internet and e-commerce. But actually, of course, COVID-19 has also damaged massively prospects for physical retail. And so equally, we might be talking to people who own former department stores that have closed down. And now the question might be, not only let's do it in this city, but let's do it on the high street, because we can bring new types of business to the high street. We're not just talking about the hair salons, although they themselves might do with some business support, but we might be talking about the more IP-fueled businesses. So really, that's how it is. And you know, what we're also trying to understand at the moment is, what's the government view? I think, as everyone knows, especially in this country now, this administration, this government, is perhaps unusual, especially for a conservative government, for a right-wing government, to recognize what might be termed industrial strategy, the idea that you need to support business and proactively support this growth in regional cities. And so also, it's probably no surprise that there will be an awful lot of investment in northern towns. So we are, of course, you know, doubling our efforts when talking in Birmingham, in the Midlands, as much as Manchester and further north, Newcastle. And we'll continue to, I suppose, ourselves try and make sure that we are both spread in the south of England, which will still have innovation and sort of economic growth requirement, but may receive less government support. And in the north, where there may be more support. We'll just have to balance all of these factors and make the best choices we can. One thing actually I wanted to add, though, about each city, which I think is very interesting, is that if we talk about the big challenges, as I've said, for innovation, which can be around human health and about planetary health, the thing that I'm most fascinated by is to say, if we were to run a low carbon innovation challenge or to support low carbon innovation businesses in Manchester, how will that be different from low carbon innovation businesses in Southampton or Brighton? And I think that's really interesting, because in Brighton, we might see more around, I don't know, the circular economy. We might see a very kind of community driven thing, which is about how each consumer's role in minimizing plastic waste is reduced. Whereas in Manchester, perhaps they have places like the Graphene Institute, which is a deep tech institute. Maybe there are ways to use that wonder material to make massively more efficient ways of, I don't know, scrubbing carbon dioxide out of the air. So I think for me, that's going to be fascinating too, not just to customize whatever we do for the unique business ecosystem of each of these cities, but also to ask the question, how will each of these cities contribute to the wider national and, of course, global challenge of human health and planetary health?
Well, that's really fascinating, talking about boosting the local ecosystem and what is already there, in a sense. I'm just curious, lastly, you know, looking at your experience in Silicon Valley, you have massive companies there that have created almost these bidding wars in cities all over the place when they talk about moving a campus to one city or another. And a lot of governments getting excited about that, thinking about what that can do for an economy as a boost for retail and all the other things, the high street, as you've talked about. I'm curious how you see it the other way, where sort of grassroots from the ground up hubs, such as the one you have created, can do even more for local communities.
This is not a quick game. This is something that takes an awful long time, and perhaps sometimes that's where governments can prefer the top down, because by inviting one or two big players into a city, you get that immediate effect. We've been doing this as a business for 5 years now. We started in West London in 2015, and just seeing the growth of some of these entrepreneurs is fantastic. These are entrepreneurs that might have graduated in 2015, started working on their sort of biomaterials company or energy as a service, as a novel battery service, a great company called Acceleron. And now their business is worth millions. They're gaining significant investments. They're employing tens of people and they're growing really fast. And that's the miraculous thing with all of this, with entrepreneurship. It's why I'm involved. I mean, it's like alchemy. How on earth do you create these amazing ideas almost out of nothing? How do you create these businesses that have strength and resilience and vision, again, almost out of nothing? It's absolutely amazing. So yes, it takes time. But as soon as you've been doing it for 5 or 10 years, you could begin to see that actually, it's pretty reliable that some amazing things will happen. And I think there's something also that has to be carefully balanced, which is not to overheat economies. I was just reading a really interesting review about the original tech city for London, you know, the Silicon Roundabout, as it was comically labelled in East London and Shoreditch. And there's concern there that too much of the shining of the spotlight on the ecosystem by the government created an inflationary environment for property. So really, the people that benefited a huge amount were the property speculators, and rents shot up. And so ultimately, how much network effect there was and how much benefit, maybe it was a bit mixed. So the general concern was that it's all very well trying to sort of heat up a system and to create a little bit more energy and a little bit more critical mass, but you can overshoot. And I think that's one of the things that we're interested to get better at, I suppose, is to understand how much support is positive and really accelerates the growth. But at what point do you begin to almost put too much into a system? It overheats and then it begins to have some negative effects.
Matt, very well said. This has been fascinating, and I'm so much looking forward to the next steps of the company and the space. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much indeed, Daniel. Great speaking with you.
Matt Hunter, co-founder and co-CEO of PlusX. Their first location is open now in Brighton. You can learn more at plusx.space. Next up on today's program, sticking with the theme of creative hubs, we catch up with Josh Wyatt, the CEO of Neuhaus, private workspace and cultural hubs for cross-industry creatives and entrepreneurs. Josh was a co-founder of Generator Hostels and was previously president of Equinox Hotels before joining Neuhaus to help grow the hospitality brand. Their members' clubs have all reopened following lockdown in New York City, Hollywood, and the renowned Bradbury Building in downtown LA. As we hear from Josh, he's used the past few months to think deeply about the direction of the business with exciting plans for the future of their community, including adding new spaces.
Over the last 5 months, like all businesses, we've had to face incredible challenges posed by the pandemic and COVID-19. Perhaps one of the biggest challenges was really trying to focus on daily our staff and our members to ensure their happiness without really truly understanding what the future holds in place for us. Looking forward and how we thought about reopening, what we found to be very true was the unfortunate reality that life under COVID-19 is going to force us to stop, to start, and to stop, and to start again and again and again. Given all of those uncertainties and all of those challenges in terms of trying to communicate a clear path forward, what we've really focused on, and indeed what it has taken us to successfully reopen this past July and August, has been a sense of providing clarity in communications with all of our members, all of our staff, and the various partners and collaborators that we so dearly depend on. It's providing that sense of calm, that island in the storm, and ensuring that people trust us, that our employees trust us, that our vendors trust us. It's just building that trust one step at a time. You know, I've often said that I feel like we're in a DeLorean from Back to the Future. We've gone back in time, 25, 50, 100 years, to the way that people used to do business. And maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that sense of a handshake, or obviously in COVID-19, a fist bump or a 6-foot socially distanced greeting. But that sense of common human connection, that sense of really trying to understand what the other person needs in a relationship, I think that is actually the silver lining of COVID-19. And that really is the lessons that we've taken away in the past few months and the lessons that we're trying to now reinforce in our business. Moving forward, our mission is that sense of conscious capitalism. It's that sense of blending the human interaction, the human spirit, understanding and really trying to help people who are facing challenges, whether it be personal challenges or especially at Neuhaus in our line of work, trying to support the myriad of creative entrepreneurs that work within our four walls or now digitally within our communities. It's really focusing on generosity, on curiosity of the time that we live in, and a sense of kindness as we move forward.
Josh Wyatt, CEO of Neuhaus. You can learn more about the business and their beautiful spaces at neuhaus.com. That's all for this week's show. My thanks to Christy Evans, who mixed and edited this show. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.